Good afternoon and welcome to Current Issues. I'm your host, Hisham Tilawi. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the second hour of our broadcast on this Saturday before Easter. I would like to wish all Christians a happy Easter and don't eat too much food. About what? Somebody. Pesach. Okay, I don't know what that is, but Jewish. Okay. Well, we wish all our Jewish listeners happy Pesach, I guess. Okay. Okay. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, and don't eat too much food now. I am suffering from something I just found out. It's called gout. I didn't know what the heck it was until yesterday. A friend of mine who is a doctor, I told him that my foot has been in pain and hurting me for the last week, and I don't remember anything falling on it or anything. I did not hit it with anything, and I thought, well, maybe my wife did something to my foot while I was sleeping, but she was innocent of that one. But I found out that gout actually is something that probably about 2 million people in the United States alone get it every year. And I didn't know anything about it. But it is something that I understand when the uric acid in the blood gets to be high and it starts crystallizing in the joints and mainly the big toe. Is basically where the joint of the big toe, that's where it crystallizes, and it hurts like no other pain you've ever experienced. But thank God everyone is telling me that don't worry about it, just change your diet, don't eat too much meat. And basically I was told that it was called, it used to be called a long time ago, the King's disease. I guess kings used to eat meat and poultry and eat a lot of eggs, and that's where people, but I tell you what, it is no fun, but we'll see how this goes. But as of right now, it hurts. And if anyone has any remedies for me, go ahead, call me and let me know about it. Anything that will, besides I am taking medications now, so I don't know how well will that go. But getting back to the Middle East, and do we have two governments or two sides of the same coin, I really believe that what Nancy Pelosi is doing is not – you see, I wrote an article about 3 months ago called The War in Iraq or Iraq, A Job Well Done, because we have managed – to succeed in achieving the Israeli objectives for Iraq, which is divide the country into separate states based on ethnic and religious, sectarian religious ways. And that's exactly what we have done. Now, anything else I can't think of as an American objective to the war, because we lost a lot of people, we killed a lot of people, and there's really nothing to show for. And now it's the time, the job is well done, it's finished, so now let's see if we can make things better for us. When we come back, I welcome your phone calls at 800-313-9443. We'll see how what you think about this. We'll be right back.
Hey, America, how does it feel to be flushed down the toilet of political intrigue and treachery into the sewer of slavery and bondage, where perverts and the godless write the rules? Our unborn children are murdered, our esteemed elders are euthanized, and everyone in between is numbered and tracked like criminals so they can be farmed by government, credit, healthcare organizations, like the chicken farmer farms his chickens. Have you had enough? Is it time to declare your liberty? It's your choice, you know. The only place to begin to declare your independence is to have enough food stored so that you never have to go stand in a bread line to give away the rest of your life or sell your children for a bowl of rice and a slice of bread. Call 800-409-5633. On the web, efoodsdirect.com. 800-409-5633.
Americans who already realize our nation is in deep trouble need special edition hard copy literature to awaken the widest possible spectrum of people to the imminence of our nation's peril. The Artificially Sweetened Times informs people that the artificial sweetener aspartame is a hidden addiction killing people worldwide with a cluster of symptoms we now call Rumsfeld's disease. Find out who's responsible for unleashing this weapon of mass misery on the world and become part of the global movement to eliminate this neurotoxic drug from our food supply. The People's Income Tax Guide cites congressional records, Supreme Court decisions, and newspaper articles at the time to prove conclusively that wages were never intended to be taxed as income. A lot has happened in the world since 9/11. The report of the Citizens Commission on 9/11 disproves the government's explanation of September 11 through a careful analysis of the evidence. The Artificially Sweetened Times, the People's Income Tax Report, and the report of the Citizens Commission on 9/11 are priced for mass distribution. Sample copies are just $3. Call 208-255-2307 or go to idaho-observer.com.
The Republic Broadcasting Network is very proud to present a new educational tool that will inform and update our listeners to the most critically important topics and issues of the day. This new 50 CD collection contains invaluable information, carefully selected from the very best shows in the RBN archives. These standard format CDs have been painstakingly edited to remove all commercials and unrelated topic content. Each CD has been divided into multiple tracks for ease of use and review in any standard CD player. Each CD targets a specific subject matter. For example, Agenda 21, vaccinations, 9/11, depleted uranium, the war in Iraq, fluoride, deception in the churches, genetically modified foods, animal RFID tags, and many more topics. We encourage you to make copies and get them out to as many people as you can. Call and order your library CDs for the price of $150, 800-724-2719, or go to the website rbnlive.com.
Sham Tilawi. All right, we're coming to you live from the Republic Broadcasting Network. This is yours truly, Sham Tilawi. You know, during the break, I was speaking with a friend who made the comment that, you know, on Easter and on Sundays, we see a lot of cars at churches and stuff, and that is an interesting thought that sometimes and you know, in the Muslim within the Muslim community, you will see very much the same thing. You know, on Fridays you will see mosques where people are there's not enough parking spaces, where people are parking on the lawn and stuff, and even though they're told to go and pray five times a day, and but you know, that's the type of religion that people or practice, not really religions. The religions are very much the same. It's people who tend to emphasize certain days. And, of course, Easter and Christmas in the Christian religion, and which is, you know, Passover and Hanukkah in the Jewish religion. And in the Muslim religion, there is the Friday, which is a main prayers day. And also the Ramadan, which when people fast during the month of Ramadan, and people pray more during that month, even though they're told to pray every day. And, you know, also on what we call the Eid, which comes after Ramadan and after the pilgrimage, which is very much like Christmas celebration, you'll see a lot of people going to mosques. And it has become more of a social event than anything else. I don't want to go into religions here, because that's the worst thing I'll be doing if we want to discuss religions, and I'm not the person to really talk about religions. But it was an interesting observation that people remember to go to church on those days. A lot of people do. But, you know, regardless of how you look or you think of religions, I believe religions are good. Don't really care what religion you are, because to me, if you are taught to do right and stay away from wrongs, that's plenty enough for me. And to me, I think doing right and staying away from wrong, it's more of a human nature than it is a learned process, because I'm sure people who never were introduced to religions, when they do something good, they know that they have done something good. And when they do something bad, they know that they had done something bad, regardless of what, if they were taught that by the religion or not. Anyhow, let's go back to what we were talking about, the Middle East. Yes. And we have a caller from Georgia. Let's go to Ted and see what you got to say, Ted.
You mentioned, I believe, that you might have gout.
Yes.
It is, I'm sure that in all probability there are ways of treating that. However, I think it's worthwhile to mention that according to Sherlock Holmes in his movie Dressed to Kill,
okay,
Dr. Samuel Johnson died of the gout.
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah.
that's what I wanted to hear from you, you know?
Well, I don't mean to discourage you. I told you, in all probability, since that time, they've developed a lot of successful treatments for it.
I hope so.
Yeah, I'm sure they have, and I'm sure that you have good sense enough to follow a good course in treatment.
But see what, I'm not going to eat meat anymore. I mean,
right.
That's what they're telling me. It's like from meat.
Yeah, that's what I would think. Uh-huh. Let me mention
it. Before?
In relation to what you've said, I'd like to restate it in a more direct way.
Okay.
Be a little more blatant about it. And that is that the way I interpret what you've said is that the American elite want to drive a wedge between Iran and Syria. Iran and Syria have these treaties whereby if you attack one, the other is going to also be brought into the fight. And but they're trying to drive a wedge between Iran and Syria. And this is what you've said. This is my interpretation of what you've said.
You're right, exactly.
Yeah, and I think that they apparently they've had some success in it, although they've not. They've not reached any conclusions yet.
Well, you see, Syria is an Arab country. Iran is not an Arab country. And it is to the best advantage or to the advantage of the Syrians to be on this side of the fence, because if Iran is attacked, Syria is basically gone. And if we are to go and attack Syria first, we're going to have some oppositions from the Arab countries, which we need them right now badly. Now, if we would have attacked Syria right after we attacked Iran, things may have been a little bit different, where the Arabs would probably have not said much about it, just as they have not said much when we went and attacked Iraq. But now it's difficult if we take any action against Syria. And in order for us to look pretty in the eyes of the Arab world, which we need, like I said, badly, the only other alternative is to get Syria on this side of the fence than being on the Iran side of the fence.
Would you mind telling me one thing?
Yes.
Exactly how is an Arab different from the Iranians?
Well, there's a lot of difference, because the Arabs, okay.
What is an Arab? Is what I'm asking you.
An Arab is someone, number one, who speaks Arabic. It's someone who there's more than one definition for an Arab, but the word Arab came from the Arab Peninsula, which is what we call Saudi Arabia now. A lot of Middle Eastern areas, they were not countries before. Before World War I, they were mainly the Ottoman Empire, and a lot of Arab-speaking countries have, I mean, Arab-speaking people, have basically migrated throughout the whole Middle East and North Africa. That's why you have the countries in the Middle East, like Syria, Iraq, and all the Gulf countries like Kuwait and United Arab Emirates. Then you have Jordan, Palestine, Egypt, North Africa like Morocco, Tunisia, and Libya, Mauritania, Sudan, for instance. All these are Arab people, which ethnically they are Arabs, and by they speak the same language, so that makes them an Arab. And also, after World War One, when the area was divided basically between the British and the French under the Sykes-Picot Agreement, they basically drawn the lines on the map and said that you take this part and we take this part and we go on to. And then the Arab world went through a period of liberation, which they liberated themselves from. Each area have liberated itself from either the British or the French. And in the case of Libya, it was the Italians who occupied it. And they became the current or today's Arab states. There are 22 Arab states. All of these Arab states are basically, the majority of the populations are Muslims. The majority of the populations are Sunnis, except in a couple of states. Like, for instance, in Iraq, it was majority Shiite. And in Bahrain, we have a Sunni government, but the majority of the population are Shiite. The Iranians, on the other hand, are Persians. And they used to have, there was a Persian empire that had, it was in existence back when Islam first came into existence back in the 600 AD. And there was a lot of wars between the Persians and the Muslims, and the Muslims eventually won the fight and dissolved the Persian Empire. And the Persian Empire have embraced Islam, or has had embraced Islam, and became a Muslim. The 99% of its population became Muslims, but they're not Arabs. As if you just to put it, as if we speak of, let's say, European white who at one time mainly were in the United States, and then you have Latin Americans or Spanish Americans in Mexico. So you have, even though both of them are Christians, they're two different ethnic groups. One is more of Spanish breed, and the other one more of a white European breed. I hope that makes it clearer for you.
Yes, what language is the Persian language? Parsi or Farsi or something like that?
Farsi, yes.
Farsi. What is it?
Farsi.
Farsi?
Yes, Farsi.
F-A-R-S-I.
F-A-R-S-I, yes.
Yeah, that's very helpful. That's all
very helpful. Which is coming from, actually, Farsi. The Arabs called the Persian, then I call him Persian, they call him Force. Probably it would be like F-O-R-S-E or something, or F-U-R-S, Force, from Farsi. And the language is Farsi. It's just like saying an Arab and Arabic and Force and Farsi, which in English the translation is Persian.
That's very helpful.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Paul. Yeah, sure. So, you know, which is a good, what he asked, you know, what are the Iranians? Because the Iranians are not Arabs, and with Syria being an Arab country on the side of the Iranians, that created a problem for the United States. You know, how can we go, you know, we want the Arab countries to be on our side, but at the same time, there is Syria there lingering, you know, in left field, and we need to bring it over. And like I said, Russian could not do it on its own, and I'll speak why the Bush could not do it. So Nancy Pelosi was chosen for the role. We'll be right back.
How are you preparing ahead for the events in the future? In the near future, we know there will be those of us that will not be able to buy or sell. Stoves & More wants to help give you the freedom from the systems of the world and from skyrocketing fuel prices. Stoves & More is a dealer for all Amish-built wood cook stoves that will give you an independence you need to cook and bake your food, dry fruits and vegetables, heat your whole house water system, and heat your home. These state-of-the-art cook stoves are nothing like grandma's old stoves. They have large, airtight, efficient fireboxes that give you an all-night burn, easily heat up to 2,000 square feet. Whether or not you're off the grid, we have products for you from stoves to Staber washers and 12 and 24 volt refrigeration. At Stoves & More, we have the perfect products to complete your preparations. For the first 10 people who purchase a stove, we'll send a free copy of our newly released DVD, Getting Started with Wood Cook Stoves. Stoves & More offers the best selection at the lowest prices on the web, so visit us at www.stovesandmoreonline.com. That website again, stovesandmoreonline.com.
Wow, that coffee smells really good.
Hey, it's terrific, and it's healthy.
Healthy coffee. How does it taste?
Well, since healthy coffee blends are pre-brewed from organic Arabica beans, they're delicious.
Gosh, I had no idea coffee could be healthy.
Yeah, this coffee boosts your immunity, has 165 antioxidants for all kinds of health benefits. Plus, it gives you energy without a lot of caffeine. And since you're a big coffee drinker, I thought, well, maybe you'd want to know about it.
It sounds great, but how much does it cost?
Well, not much at all, really. A whole lot less than we've been paying for ordinary coffee at the coffee shop.
Wow, I'd love to try it, and I bet everyone at the office would, too. Where do I get some?
Just call toll-free, 866-222-3017, or you can go to coffeeking.biz. Ask for a sample when you're there, or get set up as a preferred customer with a 25% discount. I did.
Okay, that's toll-free, 866-222-3017, or coffeeking.biz. I'll do it now. Thanks.
Did you hear about Joe Bannister, IRS Special Agent Criminal Investigator that quit the IRS a few years ago because the IRS failed to show him the law or legal authority for ordinary Americans like you and me to file and pay income tax?
What do you mean? Everyone knows that you have to file and pay income taxes.
Well, not only did the IRS fail to show Joe Bannister a law that requires you and me to file and pay income tax when Joe was working for the IRS, but even after Joe quit the IRS, the IRS failed to show up to several debates that the IRS was invited to debate Bannister about the legality of the income tax.
Wow, this is amazing information. Where can I find out more about this?
Go to the website at www.livefreenow.org. That's 760-868-4271. And the website is www.livefreenow.org.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. We are coming to you live from the Republic Broadcasting Network. I have a couple of people on the line. John from New York. Go ahead, John.
Hi. Hi. You were talking that you had a gout on your toe, and if you get the Royal Rife frequency mechanism, it shows that that treats it.
What is it?
The frequency mechanism of Royal Rife, if you pull up thepowerhour.com, they have access to that. I'm not sure if John Stattmiller has access to it or not, but it's about $1,900, and it treats 640 ailments by a frequency.
Okay.
Works well. I use one myself.
Very good. I appreciate it.
And also, as far as the war with Iran and Syria,
okay.
They had a report, and I didn't see it myself, but they said that there was a Masonic connection with the leader of Iran getting three kisses, which is an insignia of a secret handshake from the UN, I believe the UN administration, when they were in discussion together, which shows that he's in like a backdoor discussions that he's not telling to the front. I'll be honest with you, I like what he says, and I like his show, but you can never believe what's going on in front of us anymore. They're doing so many things. It's like with them putting all our military ships in that little postage stamp of a little sea area, one big nuke could knock them all out, and all of a sudden the United States would be losing its entire Pacific fleet in one shot, as they did in Pearl Harbor, except this time they would have our elite fleet. And Again, with the like the Syrians or all these countries are, most of the leaders have been put in place by the powers to be. And so the people, I went to China back in 1992, and I'm going to tell you the people were beautiful. They're people. They don't want to fight. I had our guide told us that when they had Tiananmen Square, he said that he was on the railroad tracks with thousands of other people protesting the government. And they aren't happy with what the government's doing in place either. And as I watched, like, the sales from catalogs such as, like, Harbor Freight, which is a direct tool sale out of China, they're controlling them for lower prices, which means they're starving them to death also and creating the self, you know, the slave state as they're doing here in the United States. And it's just the powers to be creating this turmoil of war and hate for each other and all these secret stories that really don't exist because they're people. They love their children. They want to live. They want to live the best that they can and have food and shelter and be comfortable. And I don't see much difference anywhere in the world other than other people trying to generate religions to fight each other and give reason for anger and hate. And it's unnecessary. So anyway, I don't know if that helps you or not. But
yeah. Thank you, John. Thank you for your call.
I appreciate it.
Thank you. Well, you know, the first comment, what John mentioned about, not the gout comment, but the definitely that $1,900 machine is probably out of my range, so I'm going to try other remedies that are much cheaper right now. But the three kisses that he talked about as being a Masonic sign, really sometimes when we talk about Masons and Masonic signs, we overdo it. I mean, sometimes I've seen books where it talks about the secret Masonic signs, and I'm sure Masons have secret signs, and I'm sure they do exist, but not every time we see something and something says, oh, three kisses. Well, being from that area, whenever you meet somebody that you haven't seen in a while, or even somebody that you meet for the first time, but let's say you're visiting them, it is a custom and a tradition to kiss them three times on the cheek. So that's how people, I mean, I do it all the time, and I'm not Masons. I do it with my friends. I do it. Now, you don't do it with friends that you see every day. But let's say you haven't seen a friend for a couple of months, or let's say you are visiting them from a different country. Mostly that's how it's used. But, you know, friends that you see every day, a handshake will be sufficient. In other parts of the Middle East, I've seen like the Saudis, they will kind of touch noses, and that's a sign of respect and a sign of saying I love you and I'm your friend. But the three kisses, it goes on in the Middle East, in Middle Eastern societies, all the time, and friends do that, and family do that. If you meet your cousins that you haven't seen in a month or so, or even, you know, even if you assume, but you're visiting them at their homes, normally the three kisses on the cheek is a social manner that is going on there. So now, is Ahmadinejad part of the Masonic group? I don't know. You know, I do believe that there are the governments that we see in front of us. Basically, they're not the governments that are making the rules. These people are basically actors. And I would say that goes on in every country in the world, that the government you see in front of you is not the government that is making the decisions, but it's the government that is executing the decisions. And that goes most likely, not most likely, for sure, in this country, because we have went to a war. We have went to a war against a country that did not mean us any harm, was not a threat to us. It was not a threat to a world peace. It was they could not eat their children. 500,000, half a million Iraqi children died of malnutrition. So the country could not even feed their children. We'll be back with your phone calls. This is Sham Tilawi. We will be back in a couple of minutes.
Thank you. You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.
Hi, Steve Shank, Fearless Task Force. Sure, you've got a mortgage and credit cards. Your debt creation is probably the smartest thing you've ever done. How would it be to find $75,000, $150,000, $200,000 or more you never knew you had? Now the task force has strategies to make these debts into virtual savings accounts. Ben Franklin said, a penny saved is a penny earned. By doing nothing more than you're doing right now, because you've used your credit, the right strategies can make the debt part of your financial life the smartest thing you've ever done. Oh, by the way, your strategies cost you nothing out of pocket. Go ahead and check out the debt elimination scams if you'd like to. You wouldn't take money from a loan shark, so you may not want to give your money to a debt shark. For an understanding of what a financial genius you truly are, call 800-409-5633. On the web, mydebtfreepath.com. 800-409-5633.
There is one and only one national populist news weekly, staffed by an unsurpassed team of veteran investigative journalists who have dared to rip the veil of deception from the cover-up stories promoted by the big money-controlled media monopoly.
American Free Press.
AFP's no-holds-barred journalists fearlessly seek the truth, no matter how controversial the issue. AFP publishes exciting, in-depth, uncensored news and information good patriotic Americans need to know to combat the coming police state being clamped in our republic. The American Free Press is your voice. Subscribe today and catch up on the real news. Mention RBN when you call and receive a one-year subscription, plus a copy of Michael Collins Piper's latest bestseller, The High Priests of War. All that for just $49. Call AFP toll-free, 888-699-NEWS, or visit AmericanFreePress.net.
Gold, ever climbing, as the dollar continues to spiral into a free fall. How long before it hits rock bottom? Between 1800 and 1913, the value of the dollar was more or less constant. Since the creation of the Federal Reserve in 1913, the value of the dollar has depreciated 97%. Due to global inflationary policies and the continued erosion of the U.S. dollar, gold and silver are still in the early stages of the greatest bull market the world has ever seen. Whether you purchase precious metals to stabilize your portfolio or you're looking for strong growth, gold and silver will provide you with both. Don't you owe it to yourself to do business with Republic Trading Group? Call us today and become a part of the raging bull in gold and silver. 1-800-691-7898. That's 1-800-691-7898. Call now. 1-800-691-7898.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You are listening live to Current Issues, coming to you from the Republic Broadcasting Network. I'm reminded via emails and instant messages that it is not just an Arab thing that about the three kisses. It's also a Mediterranean thing, like Italians, French, and Spanish. They all do it. And I'm sure other people do that. It's a sign of respect and a sign of saying, now, you don't normally kiss somebody that you're not friends with or someone that you really don't like, because you will be faking it. And so anyhow, and also some of the comments about the gout, some people saying just don't get hemorrhoids because it can get really nasty on the air. Okay. I'm sure we will not talk about that. Actually it has been good, today, because I'm sure a lot of people out there listening or somebody who might get this gout thing probably doesn't know what it is. Probably have more information about it. But let's go north of the border with Byron from Canada. Go ahead, Byron.
Hey, I just thought I was going to tell you about the French. They also kiss on the cheeks.
Okay.
And I also remember Boris Yeltsin. You remember him when he was the
right.
they used to kiss on the lips other men, which kind of freaked me out a little bit watching them kiss another male. But it's just a culture, I think, that some countries have. Getting back to, you know, he was asking you what was the difference between Arabs and Iranians. Don't you believe, though, anymore that it's pretty hard to find any nationality that can say that, you know, we are pure French or pure Germans or pure this or that with, you know, the way people – and wars probably had more to do with it where people would be displaced. And, you know, like what I'm thinking of lots is like the Russians and the Germans. When after the war, there was a lot of Germans that was taken to the Russians. And I'm sure there was, you know, marriage and stuff that took place there. And even the Italians, they say, I think northern Italy, they say northern Italy, the Italians and that are kind of blonde, blue eyes. Where the Italians closer down to the Mediterranean Sea are more darker. They look very Arabic, actually, a lot of them.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of find it it's kind of hard to think when somebody says, oh, we're this or we're that with, you know, people. You know, it's gotten to be a lot smaller world, and I think there's a lot of I'd say it'd be pretty hard-pressed where one country can say we are this or we are that anymore.
You know, I agree with you, and you're bringing up an excellent point that, you know, look at the United States. You know, even though we all claim to be Americans, we are still, you know, different ethnic groups. The United States may not be a good example, but you see, most of these countries that we are looking at now in Europe, the Middle East, leave probably China alone, even though China itself has a different ethnic groups there. Japan probably still, you know, more Japanese than let's say other countries. But you're right, because a long time ago we did not have these political entities of these particular states that we see today. It was mainly empires, and it was mainly people who did not really migrate unless there was a war and people were removed from their homelands, or a country might invade a country and bring its own people into that homeland, and it becomes, you know, these people live there for hundreds or maybe thousands of years. And then now we have these political identities that people became French, Italians. Now, with the Arab countries, the same thing would might be able, you know, we might be able to say the same thing there, because in some of these Arab countries, actually, you will find different ethnic groups who, for one reason or another, find themselves in these Arab countries. Like, for instance, in Lebanon, you do have some people who go back to Phoenicians. In Syria, Iraq, Turkey, and Iran, you have the Kurds. And, you know, in Egypt, you have the Coptic Egyptians. So I agree with you. The world is becoming smaller and smaller, and we're probably not going to see a lot of these different ethnicities out there, even though in the case of the Middle East, one thing is kind of going backwards, because in order to control the Middle East, you have to inflame these sectarian differences, which probably was not even – like, for instance, if you take Kuwaitis or Saudis or Jordanians, you know, to me, what the heck is that? These are countries that became known as Saudi Arabia or Kuwait or Qatar or after World War One, which all of these people thought of themselves as Arabs. But now we are – it's working to – our advantage, and I'm talking, when I say our, I mean the West. If we inflame these sectarians and we inflame these specific people to break up the Arab nationality between them, because, you know, the more divided they are, the better will be to control them and conquer them. So it may have been working the opposite with other countries, but in the case of the Arab countries or the Arab world, it is definitely working the opposite, because we are dividing them into these little entities that we established back after World War One.
Yeah. I was just going to say, like you, you know, when you say Arabs, like you take the Sudanese, you look at those people, and they are certainly a much different looking type of people than, say, the Lebanese, Palestinians, or the Syrians are. generally speaking, they're I know a lot of people in that Sudan war. They're trying to say now that, you know, that the Arabs, the Janawid or whatever they are, they were especially when Jewish commentators on the news, they try to make it an Arab thing against the blacks or whatever. And really, I've seen pictures, and I don't see any difference between the or very little difference between the so-called Arabs there and the ethnic blacks that live there. I think just to say it, try to say Arab is a race, I don't know if that's you can really say that anymore. Even in the Gulf area, you get a lot of the Bangladeshis, the Filipinos.
Well, these are people in the Gulf area. They are coming basically to work in these countries. So they're still Bangladesh and Pakistanis and Indians. But you have you're bringing up a good point about Sudan. Sudan is an Arab country that has different ethnicities in that country. Now, there are, by the way, you know, when you say Arabs, and the Arabs, even if we go back thousands of years, you know, a couple of thousand years ago, there used to be, I mean, there were Arabs, but they looked differently. Like, for instance, people in the south of the Arabian Peninsula, like Yemen and Oman and, you know, these different countries there, they are more, they're Arabs, but they look more, they're darker than, let's say, Arabs who live in the northern part of Saudi Arabia. And definitely in Sudan, you have people who are Arabs and they can trace themselves. But they are black. They're black Africans. You know, Sudan is an African country, but Sudan itself, especially northern Sudan, is mainly Arabs, and they can trace their ancestries back to Arab tribes. But when you go to the west, where you mentioned the Janjaweed, it is a problem. If we go back to the document that I mentioned, it was an Israeli document back in 1982, which is Strategy for Israel in the 1980s. They have specifically mentioned Sudan, and they said in Sudan you can divide the country into four different countries. One in the south, which we know the south is very much an autonomous region. One in the west, which is the Darfur region and the other states in that region. And they have created this animosities between the Arabs and the non-Arabs in Sudan, as they have started the same type of fault lines in eastern Sudan. So now you have the government there. They want to break up Sudan into four little countries. And, of course, some of these countries might secede from being in the Arab so-called Arab League, and it becomes more of an African state. And that's what they want to do. They want to break up Arab countries into smaller segments so they can control them better.
Hey, just two more quick questions, and thank you for allowing me this much time. I had a friend that worked in the Iraqi embassy. Now, I should say a friend. I talked to him hundreds of times. I never did meet him personally, but I talked to him when Saddam Hussein's regime was still in power. And we were talking about Shiite and Sunnis. And back then, he said, well, there's no difference. He said, in Baghdad, he said the Shiite and Sunnis, they were intermarrying. You know, he said, like himself, he said his mother was Shia, I think, and he said his dad was Sunni. And he said, there's no problems. What happened all of a sudden now? That is it just because that they were repressed all those years under Saddam Hussein that now they're trying to, you know, exert themselves? Or was there something that got started? And I'm going back to there was a mosque that got bombed. And I reading in the news, I know there was some British soldiers that were dressed as Arabs that got stopped one time, and they had rocket launchers and different stuff and dynamite and stuff in their vehicles, and they were arrested. Then the British came and took their tanks and knocked the jail down and took these guys back out, and they were asking questions, what are British dressed as Arabs doing with these dynamite and machine guns and stuff like this? And I'm just wondering, was there something that got the fight going between the Shiites and the Sunnis, or was it just something that's been simmering for, I heard people that on phone ins, oh, it's, you know, they've been fighting for thousands of years. And talking to this guy that in the embassy, he didn't really say that. He said they were pissed off at the Saddam Hussein's regime maybe for being repressive, but there was never this animosity between the two sects. And the other question, then I'll hang up, because I know maybe other people want to get on there. The Kurds, what did the Kurds come into Iraq? How long have they been there? Have they been as long as the Arabs? Or, you know, and where are they from? What are, you know, and what group of people do they, are, you know, what are they in, I guess, is what I'm trying to ask you. And I'll hang up and thank you for your time.
Well, actually, Byron brings up two excellent questions, one about the Shiites and the Sunnis. The Shiites and the Sunnis really did not have a problem, and you could not find a problem between Sunnis and Shiites. But the Sunnis and Shiites, it was one of the fault lines that Israel have identified in some of these Arab countries of how to break it up. Now, it's not always in every Arab country, it's not always going to be Sunnis and Shiites, because what is happening in Sudan, for instance, is not Sunnis and Shiites, because both of these people are Sunnis, as a matter of fact, in Western Sudan, but they are the fault line there is there are some Arabs and some are non-Arabs. So they could not fuel and inflame the Sunni and Shiites in Sudan, so they inflamed the Arabs and non-Arabs. And now let's go back to Iraq. Iraq, as Byron mentioned, Iraqis, you will find hundreds, if not millions, of people who will say, my dad is Sunni and my mother is Shiite. So intermarriage and people lived amongst each other. Neighborhoods were mixed neighborhoods. So how can we inflame this sectarian if these people are living peacefully and have been living peacefully amongst each other for the last 1,400 years and respected each other's beliefs? And to really talk about Sunnis and Shiites as far as the religion, there is really not too much, you know, they don't disagree in principles. The disagreement, as a matter of fact, came back afterwards, where the Shiites might think, you know, the one who should came after the death of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, is should be one who is related to the prophets, which they think that it was Ali, the cousin of Muhammad, who should have been the leader or to replace Muhammad after his death. But of course, it was somebody else named Abu Bakr, who was not related to the prophets. So that's basically one of the main differences between them. But as far as the religion itself, it's very much the same. I mean, we're not talking about Catholics and Protestants here. We're talking about the same religion. Now, it is definitely during the Saddam regime. Saddam was a Sunni, and Sunnis, they're probably about 25% of the population. And Saddam looked at Sunnis and Shiites and Kurds in the same view. He did not, and I repeat, he did not take one side over the others. We had a lot of students here who came to the United States to study. A lot of them, they were coming Sunnis and Shiites and Kurds, so it really did not really affect that the relationship between the people. But then he mentioned about these two British soldiers who were dressed up as Arabs. They were stopped at a checkpoint, at an Iraqi checkpoint, and they arrested them, and they found explosives with them. The only way, and I'm not saying that only Israel played a part in dividing the Sunnis and the Shiites, it was the strategy of the United States and the British to basically inflame this situation in Iraq, which tells you who was in control and who was in control of the American war against Iraq. It is not the Americans. It is the neocons that we always talk about, and these people are mainly Jews, mainly Jewish. Colin Powell, he did say that the administration was packed of the Jinsa crowd, which is the Jewish, it's a Jewish organization, the Jewish Institute for Security Affairs or something like that. Basically, all these people came from that particular organization that is so powerful. This is another organization besides AIPAC. AIPAC is kind of holding down our congressmen and our electoral and elections. Basically, they are the ones who exert tremendous amount of pressure on our elected officials. But then you have Jensa, who exerts a lot of pressure on those after they are elected, and mainly in the executive branch, which basically decide on who to put in what position in the administration. And Colin Powell, he did say, and I repeat, he did say that it was full of the Jensa crowd, which is mainly Jewish people. So this, you know, going back to what Byron was talking about, yes, there was not more, just one incident. There was more than one incident where it was proven that it was either British or American intelligence sources or intelligence help that actually created some of these animosities between the Shiites and the Sunnis. A lot of these suicide bombers that you hear about, they're really not suicide bombers. Like, for instance, the last one, well, not really the last one, but a couple of weeks ago, there was a suicide in a Shiite area. And I'll tell you about that story because it's an interesting story, and it sheds more light on what's going on there. We will be right back.
That coffee smells really good.
Hey, it's terrific, and it's healthy.
Healthy coffee. How does it taste?
Well, since healthy coffee blends are pre-brewed from organic Arabica beans, they're delicious.
Gosh, I had no idea coffee could be healthy.
Yeah, this coffee boosts your immunity, has 165 antioxidants for all kinds of health benefits. Plus, it gives you energy without a lot of caffeine. And since you're a big coffee drinker, I thought, well, maybe you'd want to know about it.
It sounds great, but how much does it cost?
Well, not much at all, really. A whole lot less than we've been paying for ordinary coffee at the coffee shop.
Wow. I'd love to try it, and I bet everyone at the office would, too. Where do I get some?
Just call toll-free, 866-222-3017. Or you can go to coffeeking.biz. Ask for a sample when you're there, or get set up as a preferred customer with a 25% discount. I did.
Okay, that's toll-free, 866-222-3017, or coffeeking.biz. I'll do it now. Thanks.
Hi, Steve Shank, Fearless Task Force. The J. Michael Stevens Group is shipping a lot of storable food. It's smart that you're getting going at your food supplies. 1 week after the report came out that the world had eaten more food than it produced last year, the country turned into a deep freeze, wiping out a huge part of the new crop. An example? In 24 hours, clementine oranges doubled in price. If you intend to start or finish your supply, call immediately. When you call, tell them how many adults and how many years of food you need. When there are shortages, missing items will be substituted, maintaining the quantity of food necessary. Money is not the problem. Availability is. Be careful. When food supplies get short, with no future, many retailers ship real trash to supply you. For safe food you can trust, call 800-409-5633, on the web, efoodsdirect.com, 800-409-5633.
The Idaho Observer is one of the last independent American presses and isn't afraid to print the truth. The Idaho Observer is a monthly 24-page hard copy newspaper in its fifth year of addressing important issues affecting all freedom-loving Americans. If you are concerned about the burgeoning national debt and the Orwellian police state growing up around you, then subscribe to the Idaho Observer. Only $25 for 12 monthly issues. Idaho Observer readers receive vital insight into events as they unfold. Our articles editorially emphasize activism and serve as a networking tool for like-minded individuals determined to make a difference. The Idaho Observer, printing what you need to be fully informed on issues that matter to real Americans. Go to idaho-observer.com or call 208-255-2307. That's 208-255-2307.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. We are coming to you live from the Republic Broadcasting Network. I want to spend the remaining minutes talking about the subject that Byron brought up of how did this sectarian violence between Sunnis and Shiites started or start when these people have lived together in harmony and peace for 1,400 years. There are a couple of stories. Number one, the incident that took place about 2 weeks ago in a Shiite neighborhood where about 150 mainly Shiites died of what we as the United States government termed and also the media termed as suicide bomber. The guy was selling wheat from the back of his truck. This is a guy who does this on daily basis in the same neighborhood. They know him. They know who he was. And they gathered around his truck because supplies in Iraq, it's not like go down to the local grocery store and pick up your wheat or flour or sugar like we have the privilege of doing that here. In Iraq, it is scarce. You have to go and stand in lines just to buy a rice or flour or bread to feed your family. So this guy was selling wheat from the back of his truck, and people were giving him money. He was not giving it away for nothing. And if this had been a suicide bomber, he would have just drove his truck there in this huge market where a lot of people were gathered and exploded it. But the guy was in the back of his truck selling wheat. So could that be considered a suicide bomber? No. Having the explosive in his truck does not mean that he put those explosives there or he even knew about it. So who placed those explosives in his truck? And the two that Byron was speaking of, they were supposedly British, but until now we don't know what their nationality is, because the Iraqis have captured those two dressed up as Arabs with a car full of explosives. They said they were British. Now, if they said, you know, all they had to do is just show their credentials. But as a matter of fact, before they were arrested, they started shooting at the Iraqis, and the Iraqis overwhelmed them and picked them up, took them to Basra prison. And the orders were to get those two under any cost. Now, the England could have taken a couple of days negotiating with the Iraqi supposedly government and secure the release of those two. But they had to be taking away from the Iraqis right then. They wanted them immediately. So the British sent a couple of few tanks, destroyed the prison, and rescued those two. The orders were, get those two dead or alive. You must get those two regardless of how you get them. And they got them back. Now, if they were British, why would England go through that and get them right away? In my opinion, they were not British. They were Mossad agent, and we could not afford to have that because it is well known that Mossad agents are roaming the country in Iraq and doing a lot of this work. Now, let's talk about the real big thing. Actually, it looks like we don't have time to talk about. I wanted to talk about the mosque, the Shiite mosque that started this whole thing. But I'll tell you what, if we get a chance next week, we'll talk about it, and we will be here next Saturday. For right now, just have time to say good night and go do the right thing.